Why would you want to wake up in the morning to find that your world has been turned upside down and now you're going to have to scramble? The answer to that is, if that would not excite you, you should not be working in global supply chain. You should find a different job, because this is what we do for a living.
Hello and welcome everybody to the third episode of the BVL Digital Podcast. BVL Digital is the innovation unit of BVL, the large German logistics association. I am your host, Boris Felgendreher, and the gentleman that you just heard, that was Bjørn Fang Jensen, the head of global logistics at Electrolux, a global manufacturer of appliances. So, washing machines, refrigerators, freezers, vacuum cleaners, stovetops, ovens, and stuff like that. If you're in Germany, you know AEG Haushaltsgeräte, okay? That's Electrolux. If you live in the US, you know Frigidaire, okay? That's Electrolux. Enough said. I have known Bjørn for a number of years, and I have been keen to get him onto the program because Bjørn really knows his stuff. He has been in the global logistics business for all of his career. He has seen many sides of the business from the ocean carrier perspective, from the 3PL perspective, and from the perspective of Electrolux, where he spent the last 15 years managing their global logistics. It was very typical that I caught Bjørn in between time zone travel. He had just arrived at his home base in North Carolina, so my interview with him was done remotely. And I hope the sound quality came out okay for you. In any case, Bjørn is a very interesting character who is not shy to tell you what he thinks. And that's exactly why he's on the program. We covered a lot of ground. In fact, our original conversation was over 2 hours long, so I spent quite a bit of time editing it down to a digestible episode. And I think there's something in here for everybody. For example, if you're thinking about entering the field of global logistics, you will learn about Bjørn's just super exciting international career. If you work for a carrier or a 3PL, there's a lot of stuff for you in here as well. If you're a technology vendor selling or trying to sell to Electrolux, there are some very interesting nuggets for you in here. So listen very carefully and read between the lines. And if you manage global logistics or a global supply chain, you will probably recognize the problems that Bjørn and his team are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Okay, that was a rather lengthy introduction, but I wanted to make sure that you know what you're getting into in the next hour or so. So, without further ado, here comes Bjørn Fang Jensen. Bjørn, welcome to the BVL Digital Podcast.
Thank you, Boris. Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Bjørn, you are the first English-speaking guest on the program. Congratulations.
Thank you. I would say that my German colleagues have learned a long time ago that speaking German to hide what they're saying is a very bad idea, because I understand German really well. But if I were to speak it, your ears would be hurting for several days. So let's not go there.
You know, I perused your LinkedIn profile in preparation for this interview, and I saw that you speak 8 different languages. And I swear it's the first time that I had to use a drop-down menu to get to all the 8 languages that you speak. I'm not kidding. In alphabetical order, it's like Danish, English, French, German, and it says limited working proficiency. There you go. Italian, yes. Spanish, Swedish, and Thai. Yes. Is that a fair assessment of your language
That's
skills?
Fair. I can get myself to wherever I want to go in Japan as well, in Japanese, but that's about as far as it goes.
And I would assume that that's a function of your international career at Electrolux, right?
It's a function of being Danish. Quite frankly, if you find most Danish profiles, you will find that a lot of us speak an awful lot of languages, or at least claim to. We are one of the few countries in Europe that have very few raw materials. And as a consequence of that, you'll find us in a lot of knowledge economies, if I can say it like this, right? So you'll find us in architecture, design, shipping. All these things that are not related to selling something tangible. And as a consequence, the entire education system is actually geared towards teaching us how to become global citizens.
And a global citizen you sure are. And we'll get to that in a little bit when we talk about the different places and you've spent time in and worked in. But before we do that, can you give us a quick snapshot of Electrolux as a company? I recently actually ran into the guy in Germany who did not know the brand or the name Electrolux. But when I mentioned the name AEG Elektrogeräte, Elektrohaushaltsgeräte, the eyes lit up and he knew exactly what I was talking about. So
I can. And you teed it up very nicely for me, Boris. Electrolux is one of the largest white goods manufacturers in the world. I'm not totally sure where we rank right now in terms of revenue, but in terms of revenue, and this is obviously public information, you can download it from a website, depending on the exchange rate to the Swedish krona, we sit somewhere between $14 and $18 billion a year. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't changed materially, actually, over the 15 years that I've been with the company. We manufacture only white goods. White goods is anything you'll find in your kitchen, anything mm-hmm. you'll find in your laundry room, plus air conditioners, vacuum cleaners, which is our legacy, right? I mean, that's how it all started 100 years and 10 days ago. And sundry other, what we call home comfort appliances, right? So that's what we do. The way we like to think of it is in terms of three words: taste, care, and well-being.
The basics. You've got the basics covered.
Taste, care, and well-being are the three mantras of this company right now.
And you've been with Electrolux over 15 years now, right?
A little over 15 years. Yeah, 15 years and a month, essentially. And I started in Electrolux running the supply chain for one of our divisions in Asia Pacific. I was living in Singapore at the time.
Yeah, maybe take us back to the beginnings of your career, because you have a very long and colorful career that I would love our audience to get a better understanding of. You've been on the 3PL side and the carrier side and then Electrolux. Just take us back and tell us the story of your career.
So I started my career after school in the Army.
Mm-hmm. The Danish Army.
Yeah, the very Royal Danish Fire Sprouting Army. And spent about 3 years there, left the Army with some stuff on my shoulders, but always knew that that was not necessarily going to be my future. I always had this hankering to go abroad and try what that would be like. And in those days, and here we're in 1985, sorry, that here we're really talking about a very, very few Danish companies that would even offer you that opportunity. And by an extraordinary coincidence, all three of them were in shipping. Two of them still exist. EAC no longer exists because it was bought by Maersk. But the other two do. And I chose to join Maersk. Well, I didn't choose to join Maersk. Maersk chose me to join them through a pretty exhaustive process. It was a shipping school. It was a physical school that you went to where you learned, combined with holding down a job. Mm-hmm. So you went through that process for 2 years, combined school and work. Then you went to do your exams. And if you passed all of your exams, you would be posted abroad. And that was the promise. And I think that's what attracted a lot of people. The only other option would have been to become a tour guide. But didn't really see that in my career, right? So shipping it was. And it ignited in me a lifelong passion, which I still hold, for shipping and the ways of the sea and containers and, you know, the way trade has developed or not developed, which I'm sure we'll get to talk about later. But that was my beginning. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough, or maybe I studied hard enough to pass my exams. And I got summoned to HR to be told that I was going to Bangkok.
You didn't have a choice. They just told you.
No. They pretended that you had a choice, but no, you did not.
Which is almost like the Army. You never have a choice.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. So, but in the event, I don't know anybody at that time who would have not chosen to go to Bangkok. So it was a moot point. Mm-hmm. From Bangkok, I went after a couple of years back to Copenhagen. After a couple of years, I went back to Copenhagen for a year. Then they sent me to Hong Kong, from Hong Kong to Tokyo, from Tokyo to Yokohama.
Wow.
It was an amazing ride. I then, for all kinds of reasons, decided to leave Maersk and went back to Bangkok. The company I joined there was a German freight forwarding company. After 2 years, they sent me to Malaysia. So I had the pleasure of working a year in Kuala Lumpur. We parted ways. I went and joined. And this is when really we're getting into supply chain. And again, this is really at the dawn of the concept of supply chain management in Asia. Mm-hmm. Joined a company called Excel, which at the time was just in the beginning stages of setting up in Asia. I had the privilege of participating in that for a while. Today, Excel Logistics doesn't exist anymore. Today, we know it as DHL Supply Chain, but that's a number of iterations later. After a couple of years in Bangkok with Excel, they chose to send me to the Philippines to start up the company there, which I did. So I had a year in Manila. Then through a series of mergers, I got sent back to Bangkok, was there for a year and a half. Then I was recruited to join TNT Logistics, which today is known as SIVA. There's a red line here, right? A red thread that runs through the story, which is if you're going to ask me to join your company, you're probably going to be acquired soon and change your name, right?
But it never happened with Electrolux.
Not yet.
Is there something we don't know that you want to share?
No, I don't think that will happen, but it could. But that was the red thread in the logistics industry, which of course has seen a tremendous amount of consolidation over the last, let's say, 15 years,
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 10 years. And a consolidation which is continuing, by the way, right? We're seeing DSV acquiring Panalpina. We're seeing CMA CGM essentially, for all practical purposes, acquiring SIVA. This consolidation is not going to stop anytime soon. There's plenty of room for more. But from TNT, so I worked for TNT Logistics in Singapore for 3 years. And one day I was contacted by a headhunter who asked if I would be interested in working for an appliance company in a supply chain role. And that turned out to be Electrolux. And here we are. So 2 years into that role, I was offered this global role, which is very different, right? In Electrolux, we do differentiate very distinctly between logistics and supply chain. Logistics is partially a procurement-based organization with elements of operation built into it. Supply chain is operations and manufacturing. But I stayed on this side, and it was interesting. It was a super interesting move because I said yes to the role. They moved me into it, and then I was like, man, I'm back in shipping after, 15 years away. And it turned out that nothing whatsoever had changed. It was the same companies, the same cartels, the same rate structure, the same schedules, the same trades, the same everything. But as luck would have it, and this is really what's kept me motivated and what keeps me motivated every single day, is that this was the very dawn of globalization, right?
Yep.
So we're basically in 2003, which is really when it took off.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed the face of shipping. It changed the face of globalization. It changed the face of virtually every single major manufacturing company in the world, including Electrolux.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the tremendous privilege of being part of that journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a wild ride.
Yeah, but looking at when you first started Electrolux and looking at the world now, what is the big change? What has changed?
Well, I think it's the story of every manufacturing company, Boris. I think the story used to be keep your factories close, keep your suppliers close to the factory, keep your facilities in every single country to the extent that you possibly can.
Right.
Well, that's what the supply chain textbooks used to tell you that you should do.
Right.
So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that the world changed when China, essentially, let's just call a spade, became the world's factory, right? And so just like every other company. You look at all the automotive companies in Germany right now and tell me where their factories are, if it's not in Stuttgart. They're all over the place now. And that's what happened to us as well. And why did it happen? Did it happen because we are evil people who want to shut down factories? No. It happened because we have to stay alive, right? Yeah. And so, you know, the way the world moves is the way the world moves. And you move with it or die.
And today, is it still the situation that most of your goods are manufactured in Asia and then shipped around the world, or is that not really the case?
No, I would not say that at all. So when I joined Electrolux, we had 60, I just want to pick a round number and say 65 factories. Mm-hmm. Today, we have less than 40. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is the top line hasn't changed. The number of boxes we ship around the world has changed dramatically. If you plot the top line, and you could probably do this for any company you want to do it for, any major European manufacturing company. If you plot the top line revenue of the company adjusted for exchange rates, and then on the second axis you plot the number of containers shipped around the world, you will find that it's quite a dramatic chart, as indeed it is for Electrolux, right? I mean, we are, like I said, somewhere between $14 and $18 billion a year. And that hasn't really moved dramatically. But from the day I started 15 years ago, when we had, I want to say, 15,000 TEUs that we were moving around the world until today, even though the top line hasn't changed by much other than exchange rate, we now move 180,000 TEU around
the
world.
That's incredible.
That's a hell of a change, right?
Yeah.
And that's basically globalization depicted in one chart with two lines.
You know, right? I read your annual report in preparation for our discussion today. Mm-hmm. And one thing that stuck out to me was that you're still pretty much very reliant on North America and EMEA as your key markets. How's that?
And that's just about, it's just about purchasing power, of course. It's not really, well, I mean, yeah. APAC is obviously up there. And we're kind of getting close to the point where there's data I can't share and won't share. Mm-hmm. But North America and EMEA have always been large markets. So has Latin America. If you look at the latest market data I have available for Latin America, we have something like a 50% market share in Brazil,
all right,
which is the largest country in Latin America. And the numbers, they go down a little bit, but not materially, if you add Argentina and Chile. And if you go all the way up the West Coast from Chile, they're very, very significant as well. So it's not.
It's still quite a different picture than, let's say, a German automotive manufacturer.
Yes, it is.
Who have been very, very much reliant on China as a market in the last 10, 15 years, and also very much more dependent on that market, right? If something goes wrong there.
Yes. China for us is definitely a market that has enormous potential, which we have not yet explored.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
But that was not our story. Our story was always, we have four regions, EMEA, Latin America, North America, Asia Pacific. Asia Pacific includes Australia, of course, where we have also huge market share, north of 30%, which is not insignificant. But there are markets in the world that are largely, well, they're not unexplored, but we have this philosophy in the company that if we do something, and I know this is really weird, particularly in the context of shipping companies, we have this philosophy that says we don't want to do this unless it's profitable. Mm-hmm. And if it's not profitable, there's just no way we will do it. Mm-hmm. And of course, in a country like China, like India, where you are up against very large state-owned corporations and state-subsidized corporations, there's a limit to what you can do while staying profitable.
Yeah, hard to compete there.
Yeah, it's hard to compete. And if it's hard to compete, then sometimes you just deploy your resources elsewhere.
Right.
And North America is a big market for us. We have, I don't know, 13, 14% market share of the entire North American market. We have huge market share in Latin America. We have enormous market share in Europe. why are you going to go somewhere else right now if it's not profitable? Does right. that make sense?
It does make sense. I was just thinking about my washing machine that I have in my laundry room. It's actually an AEG. So,
thank you. We appreciate your business.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. No, it's a great machine. I went through the trouble of pulling it out earlier because I wanted to find out where it's made.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say on the box. It doesn't say on the machine where it's made. Where do you think it was made? My AEG washing machine that I bought here in Germany.
So let's start with the fact that Electrolux is multiple brands, right? The right. Electrolux brand is the main brand mm-hmm. globally, but there are three other significant brands under our umbrella. The first one is AEG, like you said. The second one is Frigidaire, which accounts for almost 90% of our sales in the United States. When I live in the United States, I walk out and I tell people I work for Electrolux, and they're like, who? And I said, oh, excuse me, Frigidaire. And they're like, okay. Right, got, right, it, right. Got it. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. And Sanusi. Where is your washing machine made? If it's an AEG washing machine, my bet is that it was made in Italy.
Really? Huh. In Italy?
Yes.
I would have never guessed, out of all places, I wouldn't have guessed that my washing machine was made.
Well, it's we have a couple of factories, or three actually, left, four if you include Electrolux Professional, in northern Italy, as one of the only countries outside of Germany where we still have manufacturing capability in Western Europe.
Wow, that's interesting.
That's not to say that we moved it all to China, right? It would have been made in Italy, or it would have been made in Poland, but you're with that particular brand, I don't think it would have been made in China. I don't think so.
But there are brands that you sell here in Germany that are made in China, right?
Well, is there any manufacturer in the world that doesn't sell stuff in Germany that was made in China? No.
Actually, most of my stuff, if I look around here, was made in China.
I mean, that's...
No, but the reason I asked this question, Björn, is because I wanted to hone in on a very specific example of something like a washing machine, for example, right? Where are the parts being sourced? Where is it being assembled? Where is it then shipped to? How does it get from the source, from the parts and the stuff that goes into the machine, to how it actually then ends up in a market like Europe, for example? Can we take a very tangible, real life example of a product, like a journey of the product from source to customer?
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to drill down to two examples.
Okay.
Example one is where a plant still exists in what McKinsey insists on calling high cost countries, mm-hmm. which generally means not China.
So my washing machine made in Italy, that would be an example.
Yes. So that's why we need two examples, right? You have mm-hmm. a product that's being made, like physically manufactured, in a high cost country, and you have a product that's being sourced, finished from a low cost country. Mm-hmm. And again, let's be clear, low-cost country does not by default mean China.
Right.
It could mean 15 different countries in the world. The difference is that the product that is now being manufactured in a high-cost country, and it doesn't matter whether it's a washing machine or a cooktop or a car, is almost certainly being manufactured in a high-cost country, but with a large majority of the components that go into that product being sourced from a low-cost country and shipped around the world, which accounts for the chart we talked about earlier. Your revenue may not change, but your shipping volumes change dramatically.
And the workload for your team will accordingly.
Yeah, don't even get me started. But yeah, so that's sort of example number one, is you may well have a product that's been assembled in China or Italy or Germany, in Germany or Italy, or France or wherever. But the likelihood that that component, that product does not contain components from low-cost countries is essentially zero.
Right, right. That makes sense.
It doesn't matter what you do, whether it's a car or a washing machine or an Amazon Echo or whatever it is, it's patently ridiculous to presume that these things are all being made in country, right?
Right. Do you do your own manufacturing, or is it outsourced manufacturing?
So that brings us to example number two. Example number two is when you get to Well, we are making it ourselves as well. We have factories around the world. We have 7 factories in the United States, 3 factories in Brazil, factory in Argentina, factory in Chile, 2 factories in Asia Pacific, 9 factories in Europe, 4 factories in Africa. So it's not like we don't have our own factories. And we did. I don't want to paint this picture of this evil company that just sources everything everywhere. We manufacture a lot. We create a lot of jobs. We have almost 60,000 people working for our company. We have just invested, and this is, again, totally public knowledge, almost $1 billion in upgrading 2 factories in the United States.
And you're not just saying that because Trump is listening.
Nope, I'm not. I'm not, although I hope he is. So it's not that we're not a purchasing organization. We're a manufacturing company with a purchasing organization attached to it.
So what's roughly the split between what you manufacture yourself and what you outsource for manufacturing?
About 50-50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, if you were to take the opposite end of the spectrum, to return to our 2 examples, right? So you have certainly products that are manufactured and to a certain extent assembled by our own factories, but with a large quantity of components sourced somewhere else. Option 2 is you have stuff that's sourced. We and a whole lot of other people, essentially, we call this OEM, right?
Right.
OEM manufacturing is huge. And where is it huge? I think this is important. It's huge where this kind of manufacturing becomes a scale game, where either you choose to invest an ungodly amount of money in building factories that's going to make an ungodly amount of appliances, and hope that you yourself can sell them, or you go to someone else. And again, this does not make us different from any other manufacturing company that I can think of. It's just reality today. Mm-hmm. Where's your iPhone made?
Foxconn in China,
it's
right?
Certainly not made in Germany.
No.
Right? It's just a make or buy.
My car still is made here.
Okay, fair enough. But that's as close as you're ever going to get, right? Find anything in your house right now and tell me how many of those things were not sourced, or rather bought rather than made, by the company whose logo appears on it.
Right, sure.
So I'm not going to sit here and apologize for these decisions, because if we didn't make those decisions, we wouldn't be around.
No, you would have been gone a long time ago.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. No doubt about it.
Apple would have been gone a long time ago. Microsoft, you name it.
Yeah.
Right? Volkswagen, Daimler-Benz, name a company. If we didn't make those make versus buy decisions and choose wisely, we wouldn't be around.
Yeah.
It's just reality of the global supply chain, which is exactly how global supply chain has changed.
Let's hone in a little bit on the transportation side of things. Just going back to the example where something is manufactured in Asia and then shipped to Europe. Is most of the stuff that you ship shipped via ocean containers?
So, yes, we move everything we possibly can by ocean in full containers. And we move about 180,000 TU a year on, at last count, 29 sub-trades all over the place. We do it carrier direct. We negotiate rates directly with them. We don't use freight forwarders for that.
Which makes sense only at a certain volume, right?
Yeah, there's a break point, but we're way beyond that break point. So tipping right. point, right? Yeah. So it makes zero sense for us whatsoever to use a freight forwarder to do that. Now, we use freight forwarders for all kinds of other stuff. We use them for less than container load shipments. We use them for air cargo shipments. We, of course, use the integrators for courier shipments, both air and ground. But in terms of moving the vast majority of our stuff, the only thing that makes it remotely economical is to move it by ocean in full containers.
And then when it arrives in the port of Hamburg or Rotterdam, mm-hmm. then it gets transported by truck distribution centers throughout Europe, I assume?
Yes.
Is that whole part of or that mode under your control as well?
It is, yeah. So long as it involves a container movement, what we normally buy from the carriers is not a freight rate. We buy what we call in the business a through rate, which means, generally speaking, we don't buy freight from Shanghai to Hamburg. We buy freight from Shanghai to Rotenburg. So we kind of eliminate the handoff process and eliminate a lot of arbitrage, and we eliminate a shitload of work on our own side. And the container arrives as if by magic in Rotenburg.
Yeah, and your customers are predominantly retailers, I would assume, right?
Yes.
And do you also have your own e-commerce strategy?
We have an e-commerce platform. We are keenly aware that the world has changed a lot when it comes to working only with retailers. But at the same time, and you know this, Boris, in some ways, companies like ours, and by no means just us, find themselves between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, you'd definitely like to go to e-commerce. On the other hand, if your retailer customer looks at your salesperson and goes, well, you want to sell through Amazon? Well, then buy.
Sure.
Right? And that doesn't work. And on the third hand, if you had one, you also have a situation where e-commerce, Boris, if you know somebody who can get me free shipping, can you please have him or her send me his or her CV? Right? Yeah. It's like, come on, guys. This is not free, right? To satisfy the customer's demand for quote-unquote free shipping, and B, all of a sudden move your delivery time frame from where 7 days were acceptable to the customer to a level where 2 days is stretching it. Well, that's not free either, is it? But we tell the customer it is, of course, but it's not, right? It means more warehouses, more stock holding points, more cross stocks, more trucking, more less than truckload trucking, yada, 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 yada. It's actually not about the international supply chain. It's about the national supply chain in whichever country you're in. Mm-hmm. But the notion that it's free is nonsense. Do we have an e-commerce strategy? Yes, we do. Will I share it on this podcast? No, I won't. are we active in it? Yes, we are. Do we understand that it is changing global supply chains? Oh, hell yeah, we know. But there are three or four conundrums here that you have to solve for. And there is no right answer other than, in my personal opinion, e-commerce is the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. And switching gears a little bit, Bjorn, we've been talking about the customer expectations and just the assumption that the product would always show up on time and no patience for anything going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And what often gets overlooked is all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes to make that happen, right? And especially all the stuff that goes wrong behind the scenes that happens all the time.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And and I know you have your fair share of stories to report and to talk about when it comes to disruptions in logistics and supply chain, and which kind of goes along with this, you know, this notion, what makes this job sort of exciting is this adrenaline, this sort of aptitude for fighting fires and solving problems. Can you share a couple of examples with us of major disruptions that you and your team had to deal with?
For me, these are actually the most fun moments of the job. Which sounds perverse to a lot of people. They're like, why would you want to wake up in the morning to find that your world has been turned upside down and now you're going to have to scramble? The answer to that is, if that would not excite you, you should not be working in global supply chain. You should find a different job, because this is what we do for a living. In our company, we're damn good at it. And when I say we, I don't mean I mean we. And I don't even just mean my team. I mean we. In this company, we're damn good at it.
And just as a frame of reference, how big is your team right now?
My team is 25 people.
25 people locally or spread across the world?
Yeah. No. They're spread across the world. A lot of them have been with me for a long time. We've been through the wars quite literally. There is a reason I use the war metaphor. It's because it's a very, very apt metaphor. Because when the shit hits the fan, you better have people who know what they're doing, right? So let me give you a couple of examples. A couple of fires, one grounding.
And by fires, you mean literal fires?
Yes. One near sinking, and that's just in the last 2 months.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in the last 24 hours. No, I'm glad you...
Okay, that would be a little bit more exciting, but no. But that's in the last 2 months, yeah. I don't want to name the companies or the carriers that were involved. I'd much rather talk about the process, right? So if we go back to the well-known incidents... Oh, wait, I forgot to count the fact that almost every month, some carrier loses some of our containers over the side.
Really?
Into the ocean.
Is that common?
It happens every day. According to the International Maritime Organization, statistically these days, a vessel catches fire once around every 12 weeks. Now, I just mentioned we have 29 sub-trades. What do you reckon the odds are that we have containers on board, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you, I mean, there are two well-known examples that anyone who's listening to this podcast, right?
Just so I get that right, you were just saying the number or the incidence rate of containers going overboard just like that, just falling off a ship?
Yeah, it happens all the time. For the listeners to this podcast, I highly recommend one book. It's called Moby Duck. Moby Duck is about, I forget the exact year, but at some point an evergreen vessel lost some boxes over the side in the North Pacific in the winter, which is when carriers lose containers all the time over the side. There are estimates that more than 10,000 containers go into the ocean every year.
Incredible.
But in this case, the containers they dropped happened to be destined for Toys R Us in the United States, and they contained a bunch of plastic or rubber ducks, hippos, and crocodiles, if I remember correctly. And they all fell over the side. Somehow the containers burst open. And to this day, finding a rubber duck or crocodile or hippo somewhere on a beach remains one of the most prized treasures of any beach hunter.
I can imagine. Collector's item.
And what's really interesting about it is that they have quite literally been found on every continent in the world, including Antarctica.
That's an interesting story. It's a whole book about that.
Yeah, Moby Duck.
Moby Duck. Highly recommended. Okay.
Highly recommended.
Required reading.
Yep, required reading. The point being that these things fall over the side all the time. It usually, of course, happens in bad weather. I want to say it's less than 2 months ago that we had 12 containers lost over the side in the English Channel from a company that shall remain unnamed, and it nearly shut down a couple of our factories in Eastern Europe. So now what do? You scramble, right? I mean, the two best-known examples of recent massive disruptions, of course, we know the Hanjin collapse. We know about the Maersk cyber attack. Less known is the attempted cyber attack on the only Chinese carrier, Costco. Mm-hmm. But those are the three big ones. What people don't understand is every month something happens somewhere in the world involving a ship. Could be a grounding. It could be a flooding. It could be bad weather. It could be a strike. It could be fog. It could be you name it.
And, you know, I'm just sorry I'm interrupting, but there are these platforms now, right, that alert you of where in the world mm-hmm. things are happening and where disruptions happen.
Yes.
Are you using any of those sort of alerts?
Yes.
How you typically find out about those disruptions then through this type of?
No, we typically find out from an email or a phone call, usually actually a phone call or a text message going, you know, to be politically fairly incorrect. Shit has just happened. Mm-hmm. Please call. And it's really at that point, in my opinion, that my team earns their living. Buying stuff is easy. Negotiating low rates is easy.
It's routine.
Well, when you have the volumes that we have, it's easy. Dealing with stuff hitting the fan requires routine, experience, and a certainty that we all have each other's backs and we just need to do what we need to do. That's number one. The other thing it requires is a knowledge, and that needs, it's almost instinctive as well, which is you need to know what matters and what really doesn't matter. If, for example, a container ship loses 10 of our boxes over the side somewhere in the world, and those 10 boxes contain stuff of which you already have 3 months inventory, and it was pure replenishment. And then it loses another two boxes over the side, which contain components without which one factory is going to go down in 3 days. But this knowledge is not widely available, and to my knowledge, is not available on any platform in the world today. But this is how you're supposed to manage a crisis. That's logistics.
That's the fascinating part of it.
It is logistics, and it is the fascinating part of it. And it is, frankly, what I thrive on and what our company, and like I said, not even, it's not about me, it's not about my team, it's about hundreds of people. We saw that especially in the Hanjin and the MERS crises, are exceptionally good at.
Mm. Just going back to the role of technology, you were pointing to the fact earlier that it's still to this day, we're 2019, it's not possible to have complete visibility of everything that's going on in your supply chain across modes and down to the item level and down to the inventory level. That's not so. What happened to the promise of that becoming reality with the advent of cloud, where theoretically, and to combine that with IoT, for example, where everything in supply chain can be made visible and be trackable? What happened to that promise? Where are we on that journey? Are we still?
So the promise has been fulfilled. It is available. It wasn't a couple of years ago. Today it is. I'm not sure IoT necessarily plays a role there, because a lot of people, myself included, specifically opt out of IoT for personal security concerns. The promise has definitely been delivered. It is available. If you really want to, I visited a company in California who was affected by the Hanjin crisis, and they were an IT company that may or may not make iPhones. And within 10 minutes, they had total visibility across a James Bond-like war room of absolutely everything you just mentioned. The problem is, for your average manufacturing company, the cost of that is astronomical and completely out of reach. Mm-hmm. So it can be done. It's there.
Still a matter of cost.
It's a matter of cost, scale. If you are making super high value products and you're tied into some kind of draconian penalty agreement, you spend the money you have to spend to get the visibility you need to have. Because the cost of one disastrous incident is astronomical. But if you're not in that position, you don't make high-value products, which the vast majority of the world's manufacturing companies, including many who will be listening to the podcast, do not. And you're not tied in to draconian penalty agreements. Well, you kind of make a value call, right? There is a gigantic opportunity for someone, and there is no one out there, to my knowledge today, who can do this. And I spend, as you know, an ungodly amount of time out there trying to find out who's doing what. An enormous opportunity for someone to come up with a solution to this problem that is affordable and, importantly, implementable within a reasonable amount of time. I think we've all been part of large ERP companies or been on the receiving end of these beautiful presentations that promise the world, if only you can wait 2 years, right? I hear from your laugh that you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'm not going to name any names.
No. There are only three anyway. But, you know, the world is possible. You can have anything you could possibly want. If only you'll pay $10 million and wait for 2 years, we can totally make it happen.
Yeah, but tell me, like, currently, under those circumstances, how far does your visibility reach? What sort of control and visibility do you have?
Ours currently, well, we're moving quite fast on what we call digital supply chain. And that means that we're using, I have signed up with a couple of providers. Again, I can't name them because I'd be violating a couple of NDRs, and I kind of tend not to try and do that. Who can give us? So right now, our visibility basically is at the container level. How many containers? Where are they? What we're trying to get to, which is what every manufacturer is trying to get to, is how do we take it down to the item level? And how do we get to a point where we can apply machine learning and AI to more accurately predict when it's going to be there. And that's not just about factory, right? I mean, it's potentially ridiculous to me. Literally 2 minutes ago, I went in and checked my Amazon orders because I'm expecting something I need. That Amazon can tell me that something is 1 hour and 20 minutes away. Vast majority of manufacturers can't tell you whether it'll arrive today, tomorrow, or the next day. And the problem, and the problem with that is because they're not getting the updates. It's not that the platforms don't exist. It's that they're not hooked up to the people they need to be hooked up to. And hooking them up costs an ungodly amount of money and takes an ungodly amount of time.
So just looking across the technologies that you're currently using, what sort of technologies are absolutely vital for your day-to-day operations?
Well, for us, and this is, again, well-known, GT Nexus, your previous employer, has formed the backbone of our operations for 6 years, 7 years, something like that. We've just renewed our contract with them. But the problem with the platform here, and this is not a criticism of GT Nexus, is that it's, as in all IT, or indeed all human endeavors, garbage in, garbage out. So any platform that says what we can do is any, it doesn't matter whether the name is GT Nexus, whatever intro, whatever the name is, it really doesn't matter. What matters is if you're saying, I have a platform, it'll take all this input from party A, I'm party B, so I'm going to process it, and then you're party C, and I'm going to deliver it to you in a consolidated fashion. That's great, until what you get from party A is garbage. And to my way of thinking, and I'm not alone in this, I've heard this from people far high out or up on various very large food chains than me, is it's all garbage in, therefore, logically, garbage out. And I don't know that we're going to change that a lot in the short term. And the platforms are the platforms. They just go, well, this is what we got and this is what we're giving you, right? Enter three or four players on the world stage today. And again, I won't name them because it would be violating a number of stuff that I can't violate. Mm-hmm. But there are three or four players on the stage today who are going, we know that it's nearly always garbage in. And we're working with one of them. And what this is all about is essentially AI and big data. So it's about saying, okay, I know there's a ship on the way. It's traveling from, she's traveling from Shanghai to Long Beach. The schedule says she'll arrive on Monday at 11. Okay, we've got that. The problem is we've just pinged this ship and she's 24 hours behind schedule. And we have big data behind us, years and years and years of port data in Long Beach that says when a vessel is 24 hours late, she'll have to wait on the roads for this long. Then she'll get alongside. We know that the port of Long Beach generally has a discharge time of this. We know that it generally takes this long for the container, once it's been discharged, to get out of the port. So here's an actual get-out date that the shipping line won't tell you about for whatever reason. But we estimate, given our enormous historical database and some AI, that this container is going to be 27 hours late.
Okay, so it's dynamically estimated ETAs.
Yes.
That are generated with the help of an AI that's looking at historical data.
Yes, and they have a 98, according to themselves, they have a 98% accuracy rate, which is scary.
Interesting, and this works outside of having to work with the carriers themselves.
Yeah, because we've gotten to the point where, quite frankly, we can't trust the carriers to update. It's particularly on the destination side.
But hold on. If the system is making predictions based on historical data that has to come from ports or carriers, yep, then isn't that the same thing, garbage in, garbage out? Or what am I missing here?
No, they, well, as I understand it, the big data does not come from carriers, it comes from facts. So basically, a ship has a AIS, signal that it sends out all the time. So at this moment, if I wanted to know where any vessel from any carrier was, I could log into, I think it's shiptracker.com or shiptracking.com.
Oh, got it. It relates mostly to ship's position at one point in time.
Yeah, so you know exactly where the thing is, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then you correlate that with the arrival date, and then you go, okay, now we go into the port data and the railroad data and the trucker data, which is independent of carrier data, and we marry all of them up and we apply some AI and some history to it, and we can predict with a 98% accuracy when your cargo will actually get to the warehouse.
So this is a system that you're experimenting with?
We're working with them pretty deeply.
Cool. All right.
And there are four of them in the world. You can research them yourself. I'm sorry, I cannot give you the name.
I have a suspicion, but I'll leave it. Leave it up to the audience to find out. What other sort of exciting things are you experimenting with or think about experimenting with when it comes to technology and its use in logistics and supply chain?
Well, in logistics, not a lot. It's all about optimizing and minimizing costs. Technologies, I think we have what we need. We've, of course, looked very deeply at blockchain-related solutions. I think we need to be careful with blockchain. Not careful in the sense that it's a risk. I think we need to be careful. It's, again, personal observation, just, you know, being my usual sarcastic self. We need to be careful that we don't sit here. There used to be an expression called greenwash. Do you remember the expression greenwash?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of companies doing it today.
Yeah, so we are a very large oil company based in Houston, but we've just planted 10,000 trees in the Amazon, and therefore we are carbon neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These days, it's like all you have to do at an investors meeting is tell somebody that you have blockchain and your stock price goes up by 5%. I had this discussion with a friend of mine who happens to be deep into blockchain. Mm-hmm. And he said, I literally have CEOs calling me up, and he offers a transport solution, which happens to be based on blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And he says, I have CEOs calling me up saying, we need some blockchain. And I tell him, okay, what color would you like your blockchain to be? And how many meters of blockchain would you like? Right? Yeah. That we need to understand and remind ourselves all the time that technology is an enabler, not the answer. Blockchain has huge potential, but let's not forget that blockchain has one highly glaring limitation. Other people have to buy in, otherwise it doesn't work. Let's take TradeLens as an example.
You can't be the only guy with a fax machine.
Exactly. But that's number one. Number two is, let's say you built a blockchain shipping system. I'm now booking my container. It's being handed off. The freight forwarder gets it. And then once they've cleared it for export, it's handed off. And then the shipping line gets it back and it's handed off. And then the messages are passed to me, handed off. It's great. This is what blockchain does. Okay, now it arrives in the Bahamas. I didn't pick that because of the hurricane. I just picked a random country.
I know. I was wondering about that.
Now it's delivered in the Bahamas. And customs there says, well, where's the bill of lading? And you will look at them and go, well, this is on blockchain.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the success of any technology depends on who has bought into it.
Especially if it's a platform, like you said.
Yes.
So we're not going to see blockchain.
I think we are going to see blockchain dramatically expanding into the shipping world, which I think is fantastic. And the reason we're going to see it dramatically expand into the shipping world is that we've recently seen how a number of very, very large shipping companies have finally jumped on the TradeLens bandwagon, which is fantastic. I think what held TradeLens back was that in the beginning, it was billed as an IBM Maersk joint venture, which everybody should jump on. And of course, nobody would because of the M word. But somehow they've managed to get a number of other players on board, which are big players, right? Which is fantastic. And I look forward to seeing what they can do. But that's only step number one. Okay, great. Now you got the carriers on board. Fantastic. But in order to make this whole thing work, you have to build out the rest of the ecosystem. If you don't do that, no matter how many carriers you have on board, it will fail. Because when that customs officer in Bahamas says, where's your bill of lading? it kind of stops there, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to poo-poo blockchain. I think blockchain has it. Well, I mean, first of all, blockchain underpins a gigantic amount of the world's banking systems today, but they've done it by building the ecosystem beyond the main players.
Which is the hard part in logistics and supply chain because there's so many entities involved.
It is, and there's all kinds of reasons for that, some of which I won't mention because I'm too politically incorrect. So if I open my mouth, I'm not going to get away from that problem. But yeah.
All right. So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
But on the topic of globalization, we had initially talked about the fact that the world has evolved over the last sort of 20 years from a situation where things were made locally and sourced locally for local markets to a situation where stuff can basically get purchased and manufactured anywhere in the world and then shipped halfway or yep. all the way across the world to the respective markets.
Yeah.
And now I see two potential trends that could cause this pendulum to swing back in a way. So, and the two trends that I'm referring to are, number one, the trade wars and protectionism and tariffs that we're seeing, number one. And number two, a growing concern for the environment.
Yeah.
Would like to get your take on both of these. So let's start with protectionism and trade wars first. What is the impact of those on Electrolux, if there are any?
And it's not often that you hear me hesitate before I give an answer. Let's take the easy one, Brexit. It's currently not affecting us in the sense that every other supplier in our business, we have increased our prices in the UK. And those price increases have largely been accepted by the market. Having said that, if Brexit, especially a no-deal Brexit, is going to be the end game, which I personally don't think it is, but it could be, worst case, there's going to be a problem throughout Europe because you're going to have thousands of trucks backed up waiting to be processed going into the UK. Maybe even tens of thousands. And that is not going to be helpful to the overall Europe logistics landscape. Everybody would be affected by that, right? I mean, the notion that somehow Electrolux has found some kind of magic wand that would not let us be allowed to, or let us be affected by Brexit is of course, nonsensical. Trade wars and increased protectionism, it's affecting us in a big way. Again, it's affecting everybody in a big way. I think the biggest problem that we and everybody else has right now is that we don't know what's going to happen from one day to the other. Mm-hmm. We all wake up every morning and go, with trembling hands, you log into CNN. I refuse to log into Twitter. And sort of try and figure out what's going on, right? And sometimes you can kind of figure it out, sometimes you can't, because it could also change in 12 hours. We don't know. What we do know is that there are areas in Asia that are exempt from tariffs, and that some of our competition, by serendipity or just dumb luck, are manufacturing there and we're not. Mm. Which creates a problem, which we have, even our North American CEO has testified to Congress about this. So there's no secret. It's a public record. We know that the President of the United States has tweeted that he is aware of this and looking into it. Okay. We know that people are shifting manufacturing bases away from China and into countries that are not affected, predominantly South Korea, Vietnam, and Thailand. Nothing that's not a matter of completely public record. Sometimes that's doable and sometimes it's not. Again, my personal opinion on this, shipping-wise, not a problem. Logistics-wise, not a problem. Capacity-wise, big problem.
Sure.
It's not as easy as saying we, the whole world, shifted our entire manufacturing to China, a country with a population of whatever, 1.5 billion people.
And now we're going to Sri Lanka or to Thailand.
But now, exactly. Now we're going to go to Thailand with 62 million people, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. But again, I stress This is not necessarily the electorate's position. It's my position. But yeah, it's a mess. I do agree with you. I see it as a major influencer. But let's move it into a different context and just say, let's not let this be around Trump or Xi Jinping. Look at it more as the world is shifting into a more protectionist pattern, moving back to where it came from. Mm. That's going to be bad for global shipping, and it's going to be bad for global supply chains.
Yeah, and the other trend that we touched on earlier is the environment.
Yeah,
and here in Europe, we have young people on the streets every Friday and every other day too. It feels like.
Yep.
Demonstrating and protesting and wanting our governments and our companies and the system to change.
Yep.
Now, Electrolux is on the forefront, as far as I can tell. Yep. I think you take sustainability very, very seriously.
It's a religion for us.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that. How so?
And it goes back like 25 years. I think we've been in one of the very few companies that makes up the Dow Jones Sustainability Index.
By the way, you don't get onto that list by greenwashing.
You sure don't. No. And certainly not for 25 years in a row.
Right.
It's a religion for us. We live it in everything we do. We have moved not only in shipping as a leadership member of the Clean Cargo Working Group, but also in manufacturing, zero waste, solar panels on top of every factory. We really live it.
In other words, you didn't just recently discover this topic and jumped onto this bandwagon because it's so fashionable right now.
No. This company lives and breathes sustainability in everything it does. Manufacturing activities, purchasing activities. I mean, my purchasing decisions are at least partially and in large part driven by sustainability concerns. I have to fill in a scorecard for suppliers on this sustainability front. We took the leadership role in the Clean Cargo Working Group. We've driven down our logistics carbon footprint, global logistics carbon footprint, by almost 50% in the last 5 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But that's actually nothing compared to what other parts of the company have done. In connection with our 100-year anniversary, we've come out with an awful lot of initiatives, actually, funnily, 100 initiatives, a number of which, many of which, almost all of which are literally guided by sustainability. And here I think it's important that we have a discussion about what sustainability means. Because sustainability does not just mean minimizing your carbon footprint. That's a good start. Mm-hmm. It means responsible hiring practices. It means not discriminating. It means certainly not subjecting people to unreasonable work rules, regulations, requirements. It also means responsible sourcing, knowing where your stuff comes from. But there is this tendency in the world to say sustainability, so long as we reduce the carbon footprint, that's what it's all about. And we go far beyond that. It's the whole picture, not just the carbon.
But going back to the topic of CO2 emissions for a second, logistics, what sort of measures did you take that allowed you to so drastically lower your emissions over that period of time?
So we took conscious decisions around carrier selections, mm-hmm, based on their fleet configuration, the fleet age, their own stated contributions to CO2 reductions.
So when you're making your carrier decisions and buying decisions, you're not only looking at price, you're not only looking at service levels, but sustainability on part of the carrier is a big criteria for inside your selection process, basically.
Yeah. We call it sort of with an overall catchphrase, we call it value-based sourcing. Mm-hmm. Which is to say that value is not always about price. Now, I will also say two things. First of all, of course, carriers have helped tremendously, almost all carriers, by over the last 6 years building extremely large and extremely sustainable container ships. So the number kind of went down automatically, right? Because they did that. Mm-hmm. And of course, IMO 2020, which is coming up in 3 months, is also going to help get us to a goal that then the real challenge becomes, where do you find the next target, right?
Bjorn, I'm looking at the clock here. Mm-hmm. We've been talking for a long time, and time flies by when I talk to you. It's always a pleasure. I always like listening to you. You're full of stories and good insights, and you just have a wealth of knowledge about the industry, which is refreshing, and I enjoy listening to it. I hope our listeners feel the same, and I hope they learn something and understand the way the world of global supply chain and logistics better than it did before.
Yep, I hope so too. Always happy to receive feedback, communication, whatever.
Yeah, what's the most common platform for people to find you on? Is it LinkedIn? Is it Twitter? You said earlier Twitter is gone. You're not there any longer.
I log in, but I try not to. LinkedIn is probably the best place.
Same here. So people find you on LinkedIn. Bjorn Jensen, are you connecting with a lot of people, or should people follow you? What's your preferred method there?
Connect.
Okay. That's awesome. Well, Bjorn, thank you very, very much for your time. Very much appreciated. Thank you for being on the program. Thank you for being the first English-speaking guest. Hopefully, we'll have a larger audience than we typically have with only a German-speaking podcast. So hopefully, this was helpful to people. Again, like Bjorn said, I also like to get feedback and input. I want to make this podcast as good as it can get, because it's for the community and it's for the listeners, not for us. So
no.
Any feedback we can get. Bjorn, thanks again for being part of the program.
Hey, thank you, Boris. It was a pleasure, as always.
All right. That was the BVL Digital Podcast episode with Bjorn Fang Jensen from Electrolux. If you've made it this far, I assume that you liked what you heard. And if that's the case, it would be great if you would give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That way, the program will become easier to find for others. And in the process, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the shows that are coming. If you have constructive feedback, feel free to reach out to me directly. You will find me on LinkedIn easily, because my name is pretty unique, as long as you know how to spell it. Anyways, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time.